for years, the NCAA's legal defense has, you know, boiled down essentially been, we can't pay players because they are amateurs, and they are amateurs because we can't pay them.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, I speak with Ben Strauss of the Washington Post. He's the author of Indentured, the inside story of the rebellion against the NCAA. The Supreme Court has decided in a 9-0 ruling that the NCAA cannot enforce limits on education-related benefits that colleges offer to student athletes. The ruling on Monday did not decide whether students can be paid salaries. Under the current NCAA rules, students cannot be paid, and the scholarship money colleges offer is capped at the cost of attending the school. The NCAA had defended its rules as necessary to preserve the amateur nature of college sports as part of a long-running battle over the issue. But the court sided with former athletes, who say limits on education benefits in Division I moneymakers like basketball and football are unenforceable.
It's interesting to think about what this is and what this isn't. What it isn't is, a mechanism to tomorrow, Ohio State, Alabama, to start paying, you know, high school recruits or the best, you know, football players in the country, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars or something like that. It's a pretty narrow ruling that is very specific to things that are related to education. You know, schools can buy laptops or provide postgraduate internships, that kind of thing. So on its face, that might not seem like a big deal, but the ruling does do a couple of things, that are more important than sort of the narrowness of that ruling. First of all, it's a 9-0 decision. And so, polarized court, polarized country, anytime there's a unanimous decision sort of saying that amateurism rules are not as important or not as legally defensible as the NCAA would like is a big deal. The other thing is there are, you know, between 20 and 30 states around the country that have passed rules, new laws, I should say, where athletes can start making money off of their names and their images, you know, influencing on social media, sponsorships, that kind of thing. And this ruling will only encourage that momentum and sort of allow those sorts of laws in terms of money making for athletes to continue. And so in the larger context, it's a big deal, even if very specifically, you know, what changes tomorrow might not seem like it.
So you see this fitting in as perhaps an incremental step toward that larger change as part of this bigger fight?
Yeah, I think that's right.
You said that this doesn't necessarily mean big changes coming for big schools this week. So what does the decision mean practically for current student athletes and colleges?
The ruling itself doesn't mean that much. It just says that educational expenses, there's no limits on them anymore. So the cost of attendance, you know, players getting stipends, checks essentially for the cost of going to schools to buy supplies, travel homes, that kind of stuff. Players are already getting that. And now, schools can basically, you know, go above and beyond that as it relates to education, as I mentioned, laptops or when you graduate and want to get an internship, the schools can provide that and pay for things like that. So what it means for, you know, current players immediately, again, this itself is not a sea change. What is a bigger deal is sort of the door that it opens in terms of the NCAA's legal defenses for future cases and just the kind of legal scrutiny that the NCAA is vulnerable to. For years, the NCAA's legal defense has, you know, boiled down essentially been, we can't pay players because they are amateurs, and they are amateurs because we can't pay them. And the Supreme Court took a pretty withering look at that and said the NCAA is absolutely, can be legally scrutinized. And, this amateurism defense that they've fallen back on for years, doesn't handle a lot of legal scrutiny. The other piece of that is there was a concurrent opinion written by Justice Brett Kavanaugh that essentially said this is a very narrow issue that we looked at. But if somebody did bring the bigger case, and this case was about paying players, he expressed some pretty clear skepticism that the NCAA's legal defense would hold up to that too. And so I imagine that there's some plaintiffs' lawyers, some college athletes, current former athletes, looking at this, and salivating, having some lights go off. That this really encourages that bigger case to really test whether the NCAA can prohibit schools from offering payments to players.
How did the NCAA respond to this particular ruling and its president, Mark Emmert?
The NCAA put out a statement and said that this absolutely reinforces that there can be limits, and said they did an interview, I think it was with the USA Today, and said, don't pay much attention to the Brett Kavanaugh opinion because that's, one person, that's not binding law, which is absolutely correct. Their statement said in part, even though the decision does not directly address name, image, and likeness, the NCAA remains committed to supporting NIL benefits for student athletes. And so the NCAA is sort of really has this, this question of what it's going to do as these laws start to go into effect around NIL. And even Mark Emmert himself has, advocated some mild and small reforms around athletes being able to make money, with their Instagram followings or, with sponsorships and that kind of thing. But they haven't, they don't have a position. They haven't made any, official rulings or voiced what they're going to do on July 1st when some of these, state laws go into effect. So it's a little bit up in the air what they're going to do. I think that they thought that they would get a friendlier ruling from the Supreme Court. And not only did it go 9-0 against them, but it sort of opened the door for some of these other cases and to continue, some of this momentum we have toward increased benefits for athletes, athletes' rights, and economic benefits that they haven't had for decades.
With the caveat that the Supreme Court doesn't always move as quickly as the rest of society does on issues like this, from where you are sitting, does the whole concept of amateurism that the NCAA is built on seem like it's running out of time?
Yeah, it's interesting. The NCAA, in their statement today, sort of said that what the Supreme Court said that reaffirms their authority to have reasonable rules. And remains free to articulate, what the educational benefits are and what they're not. And that's why this case was pretty narrow. So, again, not the death knell to amateurism today, but really part of this movement. And as you look at athletes in other sports, the Major League Baseball, Curt Flood brought a case, for free agency in the 1960s, and he lost, but a few years later, baseball adopted free agency, and NFL players throughout the 1980s went to court battling with the NFL over their own free agency, their own economic rights, and it wasn't until the early 1990s that they, won a case in front of a jury where they earned their free agent rights, and then college players seem to be following a similar trajectory where it's, incremental victories, followed by incremental victories, sort of all moving in the same direction slowly until they sort of arrive at this place where they have more of these economic rights. I think it is harder for the NCAA to make their case today, than it was 30 years ago, because you're really talking about a $10 billion industry, college sports. Coaches make $10 million. Conferences are, have billion-dollar TV rights deals, and to sort of say that we can commercialize and squeeze every penny out of this operation, but not share it with the people who are on the field, who are driving the business with their labor, it's becoming more and more untenable.
Don't you think the pandemic too was an interesting coincidence here, because the March Madness tournament, the NCAA tournament of 2020, was one of the first major events that got canceled. And it happened, right as the pandemic became a public health emergency. You didn't have any games. The NCAA and the conferences took massive economic hits. And that kind of proved the player's point to a certain degree, didn't it?
Proved the player's points that
no players, no games, no money.
No players, no games, no money. It's true. I think that there's in college sports, there's this bigger question than there is in pro sports, right? In sports, you always have this question of who makes the game, right? Is it the leagues and the teams, or is it the players? And it's, you know, something that is really debated, you know, in sports and has been for, you know, decades and decades. And in recent years, it sort of moved toward the players. You know, you talk about player empowerment in the NBA, you talk about, you know, in the NFL, the way, you know, players will hold out now and sort of orchestrate what teams they want to play on. That's where we're moving. And college sports is similar to that. The argument in college sports is that Duke and, you know, Mike Krzyzewski is still bigger than the players because the players cycle through. They're there for 3 years, you know, sometimes 1 year in college basketball's case. So I think they probably have a little bit of a better argument there than, you know, the pros do. But absolutely, you know, you're talking about no, what you said, you know, no games, no players, no games, no money. There is no enterprise without the people on the field. And to say that, you know, all of the money is going to go to the people, you know, the apparatus and the system and the teams, and none of it is going to go to the players, you know, is harder and harder the more money that's going through this stuff.
Just one last thing here. You cover sports media for The Post. As the pandemic begins to wane here, what kind of trends are you seeing in how sports have been getting covered and will be covered in the weeks and months ahead?
I think one of the most interesting questions is are we going to go back to sports reporters being in the game, at the games, being in the locker rooms, you know, having the traditional access that we're accompanied or that we're used to having, that these reporters are used to having. We're seeing fans back in stadiums. We're seeing, you know, some announcers start to travel a little bit more. A lot of reporters are traveling a little bit more. But one thing that has not happened is that reporters are still not allowed into the locker room, you know, to sort of build relationships, to, you know, do one-on-one interviews, and do the sorts of reporting that in some ways really make the job. And so I think that's one thing to really watch. Like, are we going to have these reporters back in the locker rooms with the same access? And I think a lot of reporters are wondering that too. And I think that's one of the most interesting things to keep an eye on.
That's Ben Strauss from The Washington Post, and he's the author of Indentured, the Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your insights.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
All right, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.